Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 39 for September 5th, 2008. Simon Phipps. Floss Weekly is brought to you by Visa. With every purchase, Visa prevents, detects, and resolves online fraud. Safe, secure, Visa. It's time for Floss Weekly, a look at the wide, wacky, wonderful world of free Libre open source software with Mr. Randall Schwartz.
Hi, Leo.
Pearl fame of Insight Cruises Newses, now a Seaside and Squeak fanatic. And who's on the docket? Who do we skewer today, Randall?
Well, I have been working for a while to get our next guest, our guest for today. His name is Simon Phipps. He works presently at Sun. He's been there for a while, from what I understand. He's their open source Floss advocate, so I thought it would be really great to bring him around. I most recently saw him at OSCON in Portland a few weeks ago, so I reminded him that he's somebody I wanted to talk to, and he graciously said, yeah, let's move it in real quick, and we'll get on the schedule for that.
Sun has really become a big open source company.
Yeah, but I've got to say, I first met him, since you brought up the cruises, I first met him, I think, it's got to be 6 or 7 years ago on one of the very early Geek Cruises.
Oh, on a Linux World, probably, huh?
Something.
There was a Java cruise, wasn't there?
It was either a Java or an XML cruise. Okay. I can't remember which of the two it was. But it was. In fact, I was just Googling a moment ago to try to see how long ago it was. And it's on the pages that are no longer on Neil Bauman's site anymore. Right, so I can't actually go find it that way.
And the earliest Geek Cruises were really geeky. They were Linux. Perl, Java, XML. How many people come on an XML cruise?
It was crazy. You know, Tim Bray, of course. But
I'd go on it. I think that's. I'm excited. I mean, you know, this whole thing we're talking about with Laconica and XMPP is XML based.
That's all I really care. I'll go on any of these.
But Simon though is a pioneer. I mean, he's one of the guys who created Java, right?
I'm somehow involved with all that. But one of the things I really liked is that he was a great speaker on the cruise. And so as we've been, as I've been fleshing out the lists of people that I really want to put on the short list for this show, I've had my eye on him and contacted him, I think, about 6 months ago, kind of with an initial prompt. And then to see him at OSCON a few weeks ago, I said, let's do this.
Also, a long time at IBM, where he was an open source advocate at IBM. Mm-hmm. Actually, I guess chief Java and XML evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this guy's got a lot of background in this field.
A lot of nouns in his title.
A lot of nouns. So, I'll tell you, let's talk to Simon in just a second. Before we do, I don't want to taint him with any commercial interests. So, let's get the commercial out of the way. Our sponsor, once again, I'm really pleased, is Visa. I mean, don't you love it when a company like Visa gets behind open source? Visa is of course, the card I use whenever I shop, either in person or online. I've been using Visa for years. We've had them as a sponsor for several years now. New on Floss Weekly, though. We're really glad to have them. You know, when it comes to shopping online, you don't want to be worrying about, you know, is this safe? Is my credit card safe? That's why you don't have to think about online fraud when you're using your Visa. All your purchases are safe and secure. Visa uses real-time fraud monitoring to prevent, to detect, and should it happen, resolve online fraud. And I'll tell you, I have so many success stories now in my inbox from people who say, yes, it works. Yes, it did. This was my story. Zero liability. You are not liable for unauthorized purchases. It's just that simple. So whenever you're shopping, online or off, think Visa. That's peace of mind. Safe, secure, Visa. Now, let us go to Simon Phipps. I think he is in England right now, Southampton. Simon?
Sitting here in my home studio with my cup of tea.
Ah, how nice. In Southampton.
In Southampton, on the sunny south coast of England. Actually, it was sunny a couple of days ago.
Once.
That's a good omen for it being sunny again sometime in the next decade.
It's great to talk to you, Simon. How long have you been at Sun?
I've been at Sun now for 8 years. I moved there from IBM in 2000.
And were you always in charge of open source there? Or?
No, I moved into Sun to look after... Well, in actual fact, I would say that I was hired out of IBM so that I wouldn't work at IBM anymore. I spent about 2 years doing nothing of significant value at Sun, simply so that I wouldn't work for anybody else.
Oh, how frustrating. I mean, flattering, but frustrating.
Flattering and very frustrating. And it was really frustrating, but it is very nice to be paid a salary for doing absolutely nothing.
What did you do in those 2 years?
I visited Java communities, visited open source communities, tinkered with philosophical ideas around Sun's business propositions, got involved in some of the products that Sun was launching and got largely ignored by the product teams. All sorts of random stuff for a couple of years. And then I gradually started getting drawn into open source. And it turned out Denise Cooper had been working on open source at Sun for a couple of years. And there was more going on than she could cope with in her time. So I would attend things in the countries she didn't want to go to, and she would attend things in the countries I didn't want to go to, and we kind of had a happy symbiosis. And then when Sun finally became too toxic for her and she moved on to another company, I managed to get the open source beat upgraded to director level from ground level. And that was about the same time that Jonathan Schwartz became the chief executive. And he and I discussed how we were going to upscale open source at Sun. And we agreed that I would be his chief open source officer and would try and make sure that Sun did open source in a way that was legal, decent, honest, and truthful. And the heart of what we were doing was actually an open source heart rather than it just being an open source marketing position.
Why should
That's what I've been doing the last 4 years or so now.
Why should a company like Sun... be at all concerned with open source?
So, great question. The key thought is anchored in looking at trends in society. If you look at what's happened in society around the world ever since the internet became endemic, there's been what I describe as a topological shift in the structure of society. Society used to be structured on a hub-and-spoke basis, with people controlling rare resources and communications at the hub, mm-hmm. and citizens and employees at the spokes, or citizens, employees, and consumers at the spokes.
Right.
And what the pervasive nature of the internet made happen was it meant that the topology of society gradually changed from hub and spoke to mesh. And as that's happened, the way that the business interests have been conducted has gradually been migrating from a world of secrecy, mm-hmm. giving confidence and security, to a world of transparency with privacy, giving confidence and security. Mm-hmm. And we've looked at that trend, and we're absolutely convinced that if we're going to be a leading technology company in the 21st century, we have to adapt the company to live in that meshed society and to fit in with the emerging norm of transparency with privacy.
That's actually inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think that's amazing. Do you think other companies see the light in that regard?
I think that it's pretty slow spreading. One of the problems that you have as a business is that you get trapped in what I term the success trap. If you've ever read, there's a book by Richard Dawkins called Climbing Mount Improbable, where he talks about how organisms can only evolve to a pinnacle of quality.
Right.
And they can never evolve to a higher pinnacle if the route to that higher pinnacle involves degrading the organism. So they can never go down through a valley to reach a higher peak.
Right.
And it's the same with businesses. A business which is successful and profitable cannot afford to become unsuccessful and unprofitable in order to become better.
Microsoft can't tear itself down to its roots just to become a new, better company.
Absolutely not. So companies have to exploit their periods of what you might call their fallow periods. And IBM did this very successfully in 1992.
No kidding.
By using its failure to reinvent itself. And I believe that's what Sun has been doing at the beginning of this decade as well, is using a period of failure and unprofitability to transform itself. Now, other companies that have not had that blessing of failure, which is a funny phrase, but it's actually kind of true.
It's true for individuals, by the way, as well as companies.
Definitely.
Companies that haven't had that blessing of failure will indeed find themselves in a really tough place as we move into the society that is based on a mesh culture and that values transparency with privacy. And you look at the dilemma that the movie industry has got, still making loads of money. A lot of that money is based on a paranoia around keeping secrets and keeping control. They're going to have a hell of a time transforming into an industry for the networked society. And, well, guess what? We're beginning to see the symptoms of that as they attack their customers and as they try and protect outmoded business models.
I find it fascinating that you include privacy in this equation. It was, after all, Scott McNeely, as CEO of Sun, who's very famously said, privacy is over. Get over it.
Yeah, well, that's also true.
Okay.
The difficulty that you have is that if by privacy you mean secrecy, which is what a lot of people do mean,
right?
It's gone. Forget it. You've already lost. If by privacy you mean contextually controlling the quality of information that's available, then privacy is still achievable, and indeed it should be our goal as we create a transparent society. What is the value of living in a panopticon where everything is transparent and everything is known? I don't want to live there. I don't think any of us do. But on the other hand, a transparent society where motives and actions are visible for all to see is also pretty desirable. And so it seems to me that the future is one in which all the good things will come from transparency with privacy. Transparency alone leads to a panopticon. Privacy alone leads to secrecy. But transparency with privacy gives us open source, gives us open data, gives us open standards, gives us an open society.
It's like if we were playing a poker game, it would not be any fun if everybody could see all the cards all the time. But we also don't want people being able to, in the dark, reach over and grab whatever cards they want from the unspent deck.
And also, you want to know how many cards people have got in their hand.
Yeah.
It really isn't acceptable to hold all your cards under the table the whole time in a game of poker.
Right.
Okay, I'm starting. That was a good analogy, Randall. That kind of, I was having a little trouble wrapping my mind around it, but that makes sense. You can't have secrecy because that's not fair either.
Right.
The difficulty with secrecy is that secrecy is a little bit like telling lies. You know, the cost of doing it increases the longer you try and do it.
It's antithetical to transparency.
And the reason the cost increases is because we're in a society that increasingly values transparency.
Right.
And maintaining secrecy in a transparent society is very costly. It costs you in terms of your reputation, and it also costs you in terms of the measures you have to take to maintain it. So I think that secrecy is, generally speaking, an indicator of current or future failure in a mesh society.
However, privacy protects us how?
Well, privacy allows us to remain differentiated individuals. Privacy is not anonymity. Privacy is deciding to have a nuanced approach to how well you are known in different contexts.
Control.
So privacy is leaving your identity in your control.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Wow. I love this. I'm not sure what it has to do with open source. Why is open source necessary for this?
But yeah. Open source is the natural consequence of a society that's heading in this direction. Because what characterizes open source is open source is the synchronization of the self-interests of many parties. And to create an environment where people are willing to synchronize their self-interests and collaborate over code, there has to be transparency.
Yeah.
On the other hand, in open source, you know, Randall, I don't care what your motivations are for being involved in Perl. Mm-hmm. They're of no relevance to my life, because our relationship around Perl depends on code.
Yes.
And the code and the community are transparent, but your motivations and my motivations for participating in it are opaque. they're it's up to me. They're private to me.
But they're also irrelevant because of the transparency. The code speaks for itself.
Absolutely. So I'm able to maintain my privacy around my motivations and the degree of my involvement and how I'm funding it. I maintain responsibility for that which is private as well.
Ah.
On the other hand, I am able to work in an environment of transparency where all the code is known, all of its origins are known, all of its defects are potentially known. And that combination of transparency with privacy is, in my opinion, what characterizes open source. Trying to define open source in terms of licenses is kind of outmoded, in my view. Open source is about the transparency at the community level, but also the privacy in terms of my motivations and the uses to which I put the code.
It applies to so much more than open source and software. I mean, I'm interested in media, and it absolutely applies to the future of media almost one-to-one. It's a perfect metaphor.
So this is what absolutely fascinates me is I think that what we're seeing here is a meta effect in action. I think that by introducing the web browser and providing a really good reason why the world wanted to get wired, Tim Berners-Lee has triggered an epochal change in the structure of society.
Wow.
And I think it's going to work itself out in all sorts of different ways. In the UK, there's a website called theyworkforyou.com, which I absolutely love. I'm able to go there and subscribe to my member of parliament, my representative in the legislature. And every time he stands up in the Houses of Parliament in London, I get an email telling me what he just said.
Wow.
I'm able to hold him completely accountable and see him in a completely transparent environment. That means that when the next election comes, he can't come to my door and claim that he cares about technology. Because in his speaking and voting record in Parliament, I know he has never uttered a word about it.
It's public knowledge.
It always was public knowledge because it was always in Hansard, which is the Journal of Parliament.
Right.
But it's now actually there in a way that is relevant to me because of the internet. And I think we're going to see this, the internet bringing about this transition from hub and spoke to mesh, this transition from security meaning secrecy to security meaning transparency with privacy. And it's going to spread all over society, throughout commerce, throughout politics, throughout the way that software and computers are made, and over a period of decades, transform society. I've heard people comparing it to Gutenberg and the printing press.
Yeah.
Does it also mean a transition away from hierarchy to more of a peer-to-peer system? Essentially, that's what a mesh is.
Yes, I think it does imply that. The thing is that in a mesh, there's no necessary absence of status.
So there's still hierarchy.
But it isn't necessarily an immutable hierarchy.
Right.
So within one community, I may well have the reputation that makes me effectively at the top of a hierarchy. But in another community, I may be no more than a troll. And being in a mesh means that the status that I have is entirely contextual. It's not uniform and it isn't immutable.
But reputation is significant. Reputation is really the coin of the realm.
I do believe that. And when I look at Cory Doctorow's book, Down Out in the Magic Kingdom, coining that phrase "Wuffy," I think he's completely onto something there. You know, I think that he's identified the way that the online society is going to function, and as that online society more and more becomes the real world, it's going to increasingly be reputation that gives me the freedom to act, rather than wealth that gives me the freedom to act.
Your position seems very fascinating. I don't know if you've ever heard it to this degree, anything you've written or spoke about before. But it does seem also to overlap probably fairly substantially what the Free Software Foundation was set up to do. And I'm just wondering if you'd speak to the like, contrast yourself, if necessary, with Free Software Foundation and their goals.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've done since getting this job is to re-engage Sun with the Free Software Foundation. So last year we became a patron of the Free Software Foundation. Also, you know, since I've been in this job, most of the licensing that Sun has done of new projects has been under the GPL. Mm-hmm. I'd say I have a great deal of sympathy for the promotion of freedoms. When I'm talking to my manager about my job, I tell her that I think my job is to promote digital liberty and Sun's status in a society that is predicated on digital liberty. Mm. And she doesn't seem to object to that too much. So I think that I'm probably classified as the pragmatic wing of the Free Software Foundation. But these days, with Peter Brown running the organization over there, pragmatism and a place in the real world have definitely been on the agenda for FSF. So I'm pretty clearly in their camp, I think.
That's similar to what Eric Raymond did when he started talking about open software and as opposed to just the free software from the FSF.
Well, there's scope for an ideological war there that we've all of us seen in action over the last couple of years. Uh-huh. I tend to think that software freedom is an attribute of the code and of the what I can do with the code. Mm-hmm. I tend to think that open source tends to characterize more the community gathered around the free code. And I don't see a strong tension between the two concepts. I think that they describe different parts of the same set of relationships. So software freedom is about the software. Open source is about what I can, how I relate to the software in community.
If you keep going, or if Sun keeps going the direction that it's going, is there going to be any proprietary software left at Sun?
I think there is, yes. There are some things that Sun makes that we're just not going to be able to liberate, simply because of the licensing origins of those pieces of code. The other question that arises is, how do we do new things in a complex and competitive market? Mm-hmm. And while I prefer to see new things done in transparent communities, there are other voices at Sun that believe the best way to do new things is to do them privately and to then introduce them to the market from that position of being a private development.
That is a common debate everywhere, not just at Sun.
Absolutely. And so at Sun, I'm seeing an increased emphasis at the moment on the idea of ensuring that our software platforms are 100% free software that is maintained in open source communities, but that we monetize them through a subscription cloud that can contain proprietary code. And then I predict that just the natural gravity of the situation will pull that proprietary code down mm-hmm. into the open source platform over time. Mm-hmm. So to characterize that, for example, you'll see that MySQL is absolutely guaranteed to be open source and to remain open source in perpetuity. However, there are some capabilities in the subscription cloud above MySQL that are proprietary at the moment, things like the monitoring software, that Sun only makes those available to subscribers. Now, over time, and you've gone.
No, you can't hear us?
We're just being quiet. We're listening.
Yeah, the white noise went.
Oh, yeah. That was my fault. I apologize. I was sending that white noise. That was my air conditioner, and I had a microphone next to it. I totally apologize. Does this sound better? I'm so sorry. I just noticed that. I mean, it's not on the recording, but I realized I was sending it to you.
It's very reassuring having some white noise, you know.
All right. I'll mix it back in for you.
Funny story there. You know that if you look at the audio protocols used on cellular telephones, they actually mix in white and pink noise because the consumer is otherwise uncomfortable.
Too silent.
They can't hear.
Yeah.
It's too silent.
So where do you stand on that spectrum of proprietary is necessary for innovation versus open source is where innovation can happen? I presume that you're on the open source side.
I tend to be on the open source side of that equation. I think that everything starts out private because everything starts out as someone's idea.
Personal.
I believe, however, that the sooner that idea is brought into community, the sooner the originator of the idea and everyone else will be able to benefit from it.
Yeah. It's hard, though. So, originators often want to hold on.
Yes, and it's only natural also to feel that you have to get things to a certain level before you bring people in, because otherwise your vision might not be executed completely.
So what do you tell that person to reassure them that the path really is open?
I think actually you have to trust people to have the instincts to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, all of the open source engineers that I know have tremendous judgment when it comes to their code and the community it operates in. And it's pretty rare for me to feel that someone is acting in bad faith. Excuse me. Oh, must fit a kill switch.
I have one right here. It's called a cough drop, and that's what I use it for.
Yep.
It's pretty rare to find someone operating in bad faith.
Yeah.
And if an innovator tells me that they want to operate individually or just with a friend for the time being, well, they're probably right. Who am I to?
Their instinct is trustworthy.
Their instinct is almost certainly trustworthy.
Yeah.
Now, if it goes on to the point where that's being artificially sustained, that's the point at which I begin to ask questions about, hey, you know, wouldn't you be better off doing this transparently at the moment?
How did it happen that we got proprietary software at all then?
I think that's actually a very long question to answer. But it came about because of the antitrust suit against IBM. And IBM, in a generous analysis of what happened in the antitrust suit back in the decades ago, IBM had to start withholding source code in order to comply with the consent decree that they were subject to.
Oh, interesting.
Wow.
Talk about unintended consequences.
So I personally believe that it was an unintended consequence. But as with all contexts, you know, there's someone who once said, and maybe one of your listeners knows who said this, someone once said that whenever you create a system, you create the game that plays it.
Interesting.
And when you create a system where you withhold the source code, there will inevitably be someone who uses that scarcity as the foundation of a business.
Yep.
And, you know, the natural consequence of withholding the source code was the creation of a business that depended on it.
Darwin again.
Wow. So what is the business model then? I mean, if kept creating open software that everybody shares and contributes to, and where do you see Sun making their money then? How does that come about?
That's a great question to ask any successful open source person, and it, you know, I'm tempted to ask Randall the question in reverse.
Well, people on this show have already heard my answer to that at least two times.
And you know, I basically what Randall does is Randall sells his acknowledged skill in Perl,
right?
And it's the same. That's what lies at the heart of any open source business model, is selling acknowledged skill somehow. Mm-hmm. Another way of characterizing it is to say that open source business models are about monetizing at the point when the user finds value, as opposed to monetizing the promise of value, which is the old proprietary model.
Ooh, I like that.
So what does Sun do? Well, it depends on the piece of code and how value is experienced by the customer as to how we go about monetizing it. To give one pretty concrete example, we can look at Open Solaris. Mm-hmm. When we decided to open source Solaris quite a long time ago now, before it was actually open source code, we decided to stop charging for the right to use the operating system. And we made Solaris 10 available for completely free download from Sun's website.
Free, not yet. So, Libra, though.
Yeah, this is free.
As in beer.
I'll enable the RMS physical presence chip. So we made it completely without charge.
Yes.
And this is why we were making the software free. We made it without charge.
Right.
What we told people was, look, you can go get the operating system. You can use it completely without charge to do anything you want to. But Sun continues to make available subscription plans that include access to our update center, access to our support lines, a warranty that will fix bugs for you, should you need it, an indemnity against legal actions. And if any of those things are necessary for you in your business, you come and see us and we'll sell them to you. So then we went around the process of liberating the code and of releasing it under an open source approved license. And we're now in the place with OpenSolaris where we exclusively sell those subscriptions. We have a range of subscription packages for different kinds of use and different sizes of business, ranging at one end from developer support, where we'll help you with developer and sysadmin questions, right up to the other end of the scale, where we offer 24/7/365 support on installations of the operating system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of those subscription offerings continue to cost money. And actually, when you dig back in your mind, that's all anyone was ever paying for anyway. No one actually wanted to pay for the right to use. What they wanted to pay was for the benefit that they derived from using.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're still charging for, is the benefit that's derived from using.
Well, that's very interesting.
And if you don't need any skills from us to use, then you don't have to pay us anything. But we offer some pretty compelling services in there. For example, if you've got a running operating system and you would like to update the version of the ZFS file system that's inside it, you probably want to do that in a way that doesn't cause downtime. And we have packages that you can install that will do that for you, that will install the latest versions of the code without causing as little downtime as possible.
Wow.
Now, if you've got an operating system expert on staff, he can probably do that for you as well. He can probably go into the OpenSolaris community, find the latest versions of ZFS, compile them, test them, and install them on your server without causing downtime. And you've got a straight choice. You can either pay for an expert like that to be on your staff, or you can pay Sun to provide that service under subscription. That's the business model.
Now, there's one change, though, and that I want to highlight, because I think I also want to get your take on this, is that when OpenSolaris was proprietary software, but you didn't charge for it, and you charged for the services around it, you hadn't yet created your own competition about those services. The third parties couldn't, by not having the source code, couldn't go in and fix bugs or make enhancements. So when you finally opened up the source as well, aren't you cutting your own throat then?
Well, I don't think we are, no. I think that the market in a piece of growing software is as big as you want to make it.
Okay.
And having other people able to service that market simply grows the opportunity for everyone. One of the things that I used to get asked when I was back at IBM, actually, was how Sun made money on Java. And a lot of people had too narrow a vision there. They assumed Sun made all its money on Java by selling some source code or something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of the money that Sun made on Java actually came from the fact that we didn't end up in a world where all computers were using Intel chips running Windows NT. And when in 1995...
Which is a good thing, thank you. Not only did Sun benefit, but others might have as well.
Yes. Well, so when in 1995 we released Java, the future looked pretty bleak to a lot of us. It looked like it was going to be a future where every computer was Intel running Windows.
Hmm.
And Java created a whole set of possibilities that stopped that from being the case. And Sun benefited from that market that Java created. Generally speaking, I'd say that when Sun has succeeded over its 25-year history, it succeeded in cases where it has grown a market and been successful in that market. And it's failed in cases where it has tried to kill the competition.
Mm.
And going forward, it's definitely our view that we want to create markets in which we can be successful and that can grow to an unbounded degree by the involvement of others, rather than creating monopolies. We're really not terribly interested in creating monopolies.
But it's not purely out of an enlightened point of view or purely out of an altruistic point of view. It sounds like this is the best way for Sun to run its business.
Absolutely. I was having a discussion on Twitter a little bit earlier with somebody about depending on your outlook, you know, there is no such thing as altruism. On the other hand, depending on a different way of looking at the world, altruism is everywhere. Altruism is where you choose to take a path which is in the interests of others as well as yourself. And I would say we're being altruistic in that sense, I don't think we're being altruistic in the sense of acting in a way that doesn't benefit us, though.
Well, let's. I see that you're using an iPhone to post on Twitter. By the way, your Twitter handle, his Twitter handle is WebMink. Now, there's a classic example of a closed system in every respect. Would Android be preferable to an iPhone? Would an open phone be preferable?
So actually, I don't use an iPhone. I'm using. I'm actually posting from a Mac today.
Oh, all right, but I do see in your location an iPhone URL, which means you're using Twinkle or something.
I'm using Twirl.
Twirl, okay.
Which is an Adobe Air application.
Yeah, love Twirl.
Yeah.
By the way, also not open source.
You know, this is a pretty tough world if you decide to become an absolutist.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah. Would you prefer a world where it was all open?
I absolutely would. I think that to reach that world, we have to be pragmatic with urgency. You know, I'm more than happy to use tools that work. What I'm not happy with is to use tools that work, but in such a way that I have no other options in the future. You know, the key thought for me is substitutability. I don't want to use any tool which couldn't be substituted for another tool in the future.
Hmm. So interesting goal. So say before OpenOffice came along, and you wouldn't under that rule have used Microsoft Word.
I wasn't thinking the way that I think now back in those days. So actually, I was a beta tester for Microsoft Word version 1.
Oh, but there's nothing that says that there couldn't be a replacement for Microsoft Office. I mean, the nature of Office and the way it works, in fact, encourages something like OpenOffice.
Well, actually, what's kind of interesting is back in the day when Microsoft Word was introduced, it was the open office of its day in many ways, because the incumbent was WordPerfect.
Right.
And people were able to use Microsoft Word because it was able to import WordPerfect documents very effectively.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I've never been happy using things that have got data formats that lock me in forever. You know, I don't know whether you remember Sinclair, and they had a computer called the Sinclair QL,
yep.
Mm-hmm. Which had little tape drives called microdrives. And I've got all these documents that are locked up on microdrives in my desk, which, I don't have a physical device that could read them. But then even if I did have a physical device that could read them, I couldn't actually do anything with the documents that are on the tapes. And that's exactly the world that I've been struggling to get away from for most of my career.
So a DVD format would be something that you would object to on principles then?
I'm pretty unhappy about the DVD formats. In actual fact, DVD format itself isn't too much of a problem in terms of the file system that's on there, but there are many elements layered on top of that that are pretty objectionable.
Hmm. Wow. And so you don't use an iPhone, or you do?
I don't have an iPhone. I'm no absolutist here. I would use an iPhone if it was available on the carrier that I prefer to use. Unfortunately, the iPhone crosses a line that I'm not willing to cross, which is it locks me into a single carrier and a single device, and it provides me with no hope of escape.
Yes.
And I'm not willing to go to that place.
So it's a good example of that kind of closed platform that you were saying you would eschew.
Now, my hunch is that Apple is, once they have effective control of the market, I think they will begin to relax those physical controls. Because I think they have layered ways of controlling us.
So even a company as proprietary as Apple has at some point there's a motive force to get it open and transparent and private.
I think that there is, and I think we'll increasingly see companies that insist on models that are anchored on secrecy, finding it costly to maintain themselves in the market. You know, what Apple is doing is actually pretty costly, They're able to afford it because they're intensely profitable.
Well, perfect example is the iPhone application store, where developers, by NDA, are not allowed to communicate with one another.
Apparently. I've not actually heard one of them say that, though.
Yeah, I have talked to a couple, and they're very irate about it. Yeah, they're not allowed to say that. They can't even tell you that they can't tell you. That's a perfect example of where secrecy just does not serve. So, your son has opened Java. It's opened MySQL, and it's going to keep it open. What other open source projects can we expect? Solaris is open. What other open source projects can we expect?
We're pretty much through our software portfolio now. So we have OpenJDK has taken the Java platform and made it open source. And one of the things that really thrilled me this week, I don't know if you've seen the FSF's video by Stephen Fry they have on their website at fsf.org. But that video is made available through a Java applet on their webpage. And it's extremely satisfying to have, over the last 3 years, taken Java from the point where it was an exemplar of nastiness at the FSF to the point where they're using it on their website.
By the way, very cool that Stephen Fry even knows what open source software is, let alone celebrating the birthday of GNU.
Well, actually, although if you read Stephen Fry's blog, which I absolutely recommend, you'll
discover
that
he's a
polymathic geek.
Yep.
There's no question about it.
Yep. Brilliant guy. So you like it that it's in Java because it's not Flash?
No, I simply observe that 3 years ago, Java was so closed as far as the free software world was concerned,
right,
that it would never have appeared on the website.
No, right.
And just 3 years on, by working with the ClassPath community, by using the GPL as the license, and by being transparent in our operations, we've brought Java to the point where it is being used on the FSF's own website.
That is in high praise indeed, isn't it? Yeah. Big transition.
For me, that's the flagship. That's what I always wanted to do. Then I look across the rest of the portfolio. Open Solaris is, after a rather rocky start, I think he's now getting a good head of steam. It's becoming very functional, very desirable, and is operating transparently and with good involvement from people outside Sun. We've got the IDE, NetBeans, which is going from strength to strength and beginning to not just be a Java IDE, but also embrace other programming languages. One of the things we're going to be seeing in the awards program is someone has contributed some new languages to NetBeans, and it now has fantastic PHP support in there. Mm. It has Groovy support in there. It has Ruby support in there. So I'm very excited about what NetBeans is up to. And then shifting across into middleware, we're seeing a whole raft of activities in Sun's middleware activities. OpenDS for directory services, OpenSSO for single sign-on, Glassfish, the web application server and related software. Mm-hmm. We're seeing new work happening around the web server and Sun beginning to invest in Apache HTTPD. We're seeing some new work happening around social software. So you'll have seen Dave Johnson, who is the author of Roller, being involved in a thing called Social Suite. Mm. So I think we're touching pretty much all of the things that we could be touching in terms of pure software. So the next evolution is to move on from there out into our other products. The storage products are now beginning to be based on open source and on ZFS. And we have an initiative called Open Storage, which means that you can go buy white box hardware and put the same software inside your white box hardware that Sun has put inside its storage products and build your own high-integrity storage products without having to pay a fee for the know-how.
Wow.
We're also seeing the chip people have been pretty energized about open source for a while now. And we have OpenSpark, which takes the Spark chip Verilog designs and makes them available under the GPL.
Wow.
And that's resulted in people around the world picking up those designs and making new chips from them.
That's fantastic.
So you can go, if you want to, you can go get yourself an FPGA. You have to get a pretty large FPGA, but you can get yourself an FPGA and you can burn into it a Spark chip of your own design derived from OpenSpark.
That's very cool. I love that. That's great.
What kinds of things would people do to customize that, though? Add new instructions or make things faster or something?
Typically what they're actually doing is cutting it down, taking out capabilities they don't think are needed.
Oh.
So one of the designs is, I don't know how familiar you are with the current state of Spark chips, but the UltraSpark T2 chip design has got multiple threads per core.
Okay.
It's got multiple cores per die. It has a floating point unit per core. And so people have looked at that and said, hey, that's way too complex to put in a digital camera. Mm-hmm. And they've extracted just one core with no floating point unit and made a something with the same instruction set, but that can be burned into an FPGA. And wow. that's now being used in consumer electronics over in the Far East. We're seeing that university departments are using the OpenSpark designs to teach students modern chip design, because rather than having to have some funky cardboard model, they can actually get a real commercial quality chip and take apart the design.
This is similar to what happened when Unix was first released. It was open to universities, and they used it as instructions on how a full modern operating system works.
Right, right.
Absolutely. And, you know, to be honest, that's our motivation here, is we figure that to grow the market for these technologies, the best way thing to do is to make them widely understood, widely familiar, and mm-hmm. people use what they understand and that with which they're familiar.
Incredible. So you've covered all of software, all of hardware. Anything left?
With semiconductors, we've been looking into systems. So one of the projects that my team has been running over the last couple of years has been a project to open up all of our hardware documentation.
Wow.
And we got an angry comment from Theo Durat a couple of years ago asking why we weren't making our chip designs available, or not our chip designs, the documentation for our I/O chips available in our hardware. Mm-hmm. And we looked inside the company and said, well, you know, the reason we don't make it available is because we're very cautious about creating liability and about cascading the risk that we've taken from our suppliers out to the open community. But, mm-hmm. hey, we can probably mitigate that with it not too expensively. So we created an open documentation wiki, and we invited members of the BSD communities to ask for the documentation that they needed to help make OpenBSD and FreeBSD more capable. Mm-hmm. And over the last couple of years, we've released dozens and dozens of documents on chips in both out-of-date and current Sun equipment, so that OpenBSD and FreeBSD are able to run on most Sun hardware now. And actually, we got a comment from Theo just recently saying that he's amazed by how far we've come over that time. We're not perfect yet, but we've come 90% of the way.
Well, it's clearly because of the vision of people like you at the helm, making it this possible. I'm really just, you know, from listening to your accomplishments so far, I'm really happy that somebody of your stature is there at Sun making this happen.
Oh, flattery will get you everywhere. Thank you.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have a very interesting worldview and very subversive, but it sounds like at the same time evolution's on your side.
Well, one hopes so. So, you know, that I've actually changed jobs at Sun over the last couple of months. And I'm now, my job title is now Chief Open Source and Open Standards Officer. And I've got the Sun's Open Standards team working for me. And one of my goals now is to try and find ways of making the standardization environment more open source friendly. Mm. And also of working with international governments to get them to base their procurement and national development strategies on open source and open standards rather than on proprietary activities and backhanders from American corporations.
Yeah, Brazil, for instance, it sounds like they're on the way to doing something like that.
Absolutely. There are several governments that are heading in great directions. Brazil is one of them, Argentina, South Africa. I'm actually on the board of the China Open Source Promotion Union, and China is following a fascinating path towards technology modernization.
It's very interesting because, of course, on the one hand, they're known worldwide as being one of the hotbeds of piracy, but they have their own Linux distribution. Do you think the prognosis is good for China in open source?
You have to observe that you can't pirate free software.
That's right.
And
that's right.
In China they are very thoughtful and very observant,
uh-huh.
and they have recognized both how Western corporations use world trade rules to their yes. benefit and to the detriment of international yes. developing countries.
It's economic imperialism, absolutely.
The Chinese have adopted some of the same tricks themselves as to create protectionist barriers for their own markets. And in the same way, they've also recognized that open source and the international software commons provides huge opportunities for them in developing their technology economy rapidly and without having to sell their souls to foreign corporations.
Right.
So that they're following both paths. That they are indeed following a path of using protected IP to grow their economy. They're also following a path of increasing open source. And of all the places in the world that we're engaged at the moment, China is one of the fastest growing open source environments. Mm. We have an open source lab there in Beijing, where a great deal of our work on user interfaces is done. And we are involved in, yes, it's almost hundreds of universities across China who are thirsty for open source software and the knowledge that comes with it.
Wow. What effect has Sun taking this very forward-looking broad position on open source had with what had been considered the traditional peers, industry competitors in your area? Does it help?
So it provides challenges, to be honest.
Yeah.
We find that there aren't very many companies that have the same worldview that we do. Uh-huh. That was true before this decade. I'd say that Sun's worldview has for a long time been that we want to be successful in growing markets rather than monopolize existing ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that has often put us at odds with partners and competitors who didn't really understand that, who thought that the only way to do business was to kill the competition and steal their market. Now in this decade, we're fairly often finding ourselves with partners and competitors who think that open source is about giving everything away and making no money. And they look with extreme suspicion on what we're doing. And no, quite understandably, if your worldview is that the only way that you can make money is by keeping secrets and selling access to them,
yeah,
you're going to think that someone who doesn't keep secrets is completely crazy.
Well, you're screwing up the game.
And there's that aspect, too.
You're breaking the rules and... You're forcing them to adopt either tighter secrecy or ultimately to go open. Do you think who's going to win in a competition between an open company and a secret company?
A secret company with enormous wealth and market power is very hard to beat.
Yeah.
I observe that we prefer to do business in the market that they're leaving behind.
Find the niche.
Not so much the niche. To answer the question differently for you, I introduced Java into IBM in 1995, along with four other managers there. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of my time in the following 5 years attending conferences where people were asking, should they pick Java or .NET?
Yeah.
And, the deal is that that's the wrong question to ask. If you've decided that you want to treat IT as something that someone else makes all the architectural decisions, .NET's probably perfect for you. If you want to build software where you have the freedom to make all the architectural decisions, you probably need to be using Java.
Mm-hmm.
And that decision about treating IT as a commodity or as a competitive weapon is one that gets made way before you get to looking at the actual technologies involved. And it's kind of the same here. There are a whole load of people who are very happy to leave all the decisions about their technology to Microsoft or Apple. And that market isn't going away anytime soon, and that market is very lucrative. On the other hand, there's a whole load of people who really don't want to leave their technology decisions to somebody else to make for them. And the rest of the IT market also finds those people very profitable to deal with.
Mm.
I don't think it's about finding niches. I think it's more about seeing that there's different strokes for different folks. Having said that, I believe that the gravitational force of the mesh society that the internet is making is inescapable. And we'll see more and more businesses heading towards transparency with privacy as time goes by.
So you're saying that the new school people, the people that are coming up now and coming into power and coming into needing services and technologies and access to them, they're sort of driving this as well because they're used to they've grown up in the modern digital world now.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Wow.
It's an idea whose time has come.
Exactly.
Well, I love the vision of the world that you are espousing, Simon, and I have to say, I think the time might be on your side. And after all, it is Sun that was the first to say the network is the computer. Sun has been a visionary all along, and I love the idea that it might be leading the way into this open source charge.
I'm pretty happy about that. When you look at the history of Sun, you'll see that Sun has been on either at the center or on the periphery of this movement all along. When you look back at the origins of the FSF, you discover that one of the motivations to write the GPL for Richard Stallman was a dispute with James Gosling, who invented Java. And no matter how far back you look in history, you find touch points over things like NFS or TCL/TK or Java or Open Solaris or whatever. And you also find tension points over things like BSD or GPL, over things like Unix or GNU, over things like whether Emacs should be distributed commercially or whether it should always be distributed without charge.
And you're saying these aren't nitpicky details, but these are, in fact, the stages of evolution.
Yes. So I was having a conversation with a customer a little bit earlier on, actually, talking to them about the stages that businesses go through as they become open source businesses. And I definitely see an evolutionary cycle in becoming an open source business.
So the first step is to make it free, as in beer, no charge.
And actually, there's a stage before there.
Yeah.
That you know the instinct to keep secrets is so strong in most software companies.
Yes.
That the first stage that people go through is the willingness to collaborate with their friends and customers.
Mm. Mm.
And you know that's Microsoft Shared Source, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And every business that has depended on secret software and secret source goes through that first stage of wanting to open up but retain control and boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
They then go on to a stage where they realize that they can be completely open but under the terms of a license. And so that's the stage where companies are busy nitpicking over every line in every license and trying to work out the perfect licenses. It's that stage of maturity that led to license proliferation at OSI, and it was inevitable in my view.
Yeah. Then
the stage beyond there is where they begin to realize that code is king and that the license doesn't matter so much as long as the code gets written and gets written fast and well. And then there's a stage beyond there where people begin to realize that community is king and that actually you don't have to write all the code and you don't have to control all the code. It's actually the community where all the benefits that make you successful are going to come from. And I see businesses moving gradually along that maturity timescale, going through each of the phases and believing it's the end point.
Right.
It may be that there's a point on after community that I haven't seen yet. This is interestingly analogous to James Fowler's Stages of Faith, where he looks at the stages that religious faith goes through.
Yeah. Mm.
Do you think Microsoft will ever further their way down that?
Well, what stage are they in right now?
They're at the transition from between stage one and stage two at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
They've done the shared source thing and they've realized it doesn't buy them much. And they're now fretting over licenses.
Right.
So you saw that wave of new licenses that came into OSI from them.
Right.
Mm. They have a fundamental problem, which is that they're too successful with their proprietary code to be able to make the sacrifices that they need to become successful in open source. But the time will come. They'll get there in the end. The fact they're going to get there in the end doesn't make me any more positively disposed towards them now, of course.
Would you say Sun is... this has been a successful transition for Sun? That you're building the markets that you intended to build and succeeding in those markets?
So actually, you quoted Scott McNeely a little bit earlier, saying that the network was the computer.
Yeah.
When that term was coined, no one at Sun understood how profoundly true it was going to turn out to be.
Mm.
And where we are now, I don't think any of us, when we started on our path to open source, with I think the thing that was the real start of our move towards open source was when we donated Tomcat to Apache.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone who saw that act back at the beginning of the decade would have any idea that we were going to become what we are now. And I don't think anyone has got any idea what we'll be in 5 years.
Mm.
Now, I am utterly thrilled that we've got the Java platform open source under the GPL.
Yeah.
I am pretty delighted that we have Unix open source at last. I am pretty pleased that we have a whole range of projects being released under open source licenses. I'd like to see us becoming more open-handed in the communities where we're working. I think we actually do a fantastic job in OpenJDK and Open Solaris at the moment. But there's definitely better places that we can get to over time. So I'm pleased with what we've achieved. I'm eager to press on to doing better things. I don't by any means think we've reached the end of the journey yet.
Mm.
Simon, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I could talk for hours. I don't want to keep you all night. Just a fascinating look at this. And I think it's, you know, often we're so meshed in the details. You know, we're still at the license stage or the code stage. We don't take this higher level look at what's actually happening. And it's been really an eye opener to hear your views of the evolution of business and the evolution of open source. And it seems absolutely right on. Fascinating. And very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Definitely. You know, one thing I will say is that if any of your listeners think that I'm really screwing up at the moment, I'd really like to hear from them. We set up an email address a couple of years ago called ombudsman@sun.com, where we invite anyone who thinks that Sun is really screwing up to send an email saying how and why, and mm-hmm. I'll make sure that somebody independently appraises that email and acts on it.
Ombudsman@sun.com. That's great.
So, I want to hear from people at ombudsman@sun.com first rather than in the register, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, you know, they got to sell papers. What they're doing what they can. Simon, thanks so much for talking to us. We really appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thanks very much, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, that's a fascinating conversation. I unexpectedly insightful and, well, I don't know why it was unexpected. I mean, here's a guy who was on the team that created Java. Mm-hmm. He's been instrumental in getting Java open source, which must, you know, considering it took from 1995 to 2008. That's been a long journey.
Absolutely.
Well, the thing you've got to reflect on there is that back when Java was released, really open source wasn't a current meme. And the way that we did it in 1995 was, in many ways, the precursor of what was going to happen in 1999 around Mozilla and Linux.
I remember Sun always saying, well, it's open. It's not open source, but it's open.
Mm-hmm.
We're not asserting proprietary rights to it, I guess, was the point.
Well, I think that people had seen the potential of an open community and wanted to go to that place. But no one had really done that in a commercial way on a large scale at that point.
Right.
And so Sun did a whole lot of experimenting. And unfortunately, the experiment was too successful. And that was really what held Java back for so long, was Java was overwhelmingly successful between 96 and 2001. Mm-hmm. And Sun was too busy helping the fish jump into the boat to actually learn any way of fishing the way the rest of the world does.
Again, failure can be very, very instructive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, now I will let you go. Thank you, Simon. I'm glad you stuck around. That was great.
I'll keep on eavesdropping.
If I say anything wrong, just jump in.
Oh, I will.
I do enjoy the idea of transparency and the fact that Sun says, if we're saying or doing something stupid, you tell us. And actually having an email address for that is revolutionary. I mean, that's I didn't immediately get transparency and privacy, but I think you did a great job, Randall, of making that clear with that poker analogy.
And maybe I should write books or something. I don't know.
It's clearly though the direction we want the whole world to move in. You know, I mean,
and I was just thinking as he was talking about all that stuff, the analogy to what's happening in old media versus new media. I mean, in what you're doing
exactly.
You're recognizing that it's the community that actually makes the show. It's not that you can get the sound of your voice out to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people through a channel that has to be paid for up front to even have access to it. That can, you're seeing that it's about community, and all podcasting seems to be about that. All new media seems to be about that.
Well, you know, when you say we're moving from a hub and spoke model, which is a perfect model for broadcast media, to mm-hmm. a mesh model, which is a perfect model for new media. I mean, it's exactly the transition that's occurring. And mm-hmm. And I think new media can only succeed if it's transparent. That's what people are craving, frankly, is transparency, authenticity. And yet I love the idea, and this, from personal reasons, I love the idea of privacy in the context that Simon put it, of maintaining a point of view, maintaining a personal integrity. You have to show your cards above the table, but you don't have to show the contents of the cards. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of reassuring to me, because I think what happens sometimes, it's really true in new media, is transparency can go so far that you actually lose any sense of self, you know, of any sense of point of view, any sense of vision or of creation. And everybody in open source wants to still be a creator, wants to still have that opportunity to put forth their point of view. That's mm-hmm. very important to us all, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and it's good. Open source doesn't mean that. Doesn't mean you're giving up that. Mm-hmm. It means you're participating in a community in a transparent way. I like that a lot. I thought that was really, really an exciting idea.
Mm-hmm.
What a brave new world we live in.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Just it's an incredible opportunity for all of us to see. I mean, I was just thinking that, like, you know, with like the All Voices group that we interviewed a few weeks back at NME, was just to talk to people who are using this mesh of communication as a way of sort of filtering out the nonsense and bringing more truth to it. It's just really
this
cool.
This is that website, allvoices.com, where instead of having an editorial intermediary between the first person information and the reader, it's kind of done by a computer. It's automatically, it's not filtered, it's automatically organized geographically, and you go to allvoices.com and you can see what's happening around the world. You know, I'm watching, it's very interesting watching what's happening at the Republican National Convention right now, especially on Twitter. There are a number of protests are organizing using Twitter. And then I'm watching CNN, and I'm seeing the anchors say, Twitter us. And it, all of a sudden, it does seem like this, we suddenly, something's cracked, and we are in a new world where there's not much distinction between a CNN anchor and a guy on the street in St. Paul. I mean, it's very interesting.
And it's so two-way. I mean,
that's right. You know, that's what's great.
I remember growing up and thinking that the editorial page where people could write letters into my local newspaper was kind of cool and fascinating. It was like,
right.
How, you know, this sort of, you know, keeps them honest, because people can write in and say, you know, the only downside was that, you know, whoever chose the letters had ultimate control of that page.
Yeah.
And that was still the publisher. And now we're getting to the point where, you know, if CNN says something that doesn't make any sense, I can go on my blog and say, I was there. This is what happened.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah. So yet another fascinating floss. You know, I love the mix between the highly technical stuff and the highly philosophical stuff. That's one of the things that makes this show particularly interesting, is we get these great juxtapositions. And you're doing a great job of programming it, so to speak. Who's coming up? Anybody we should know about?
I have coming up on the short list, we have Ken Core of the Apache Software Foundation and other things. I bump into him all the time at international conferences, and it's about time we had him on the show. I also have, I'm looking at my calendar real quickly here, I believe we have coming up Roger Dannenberg, whose name I totally mangled last week. I'm so sorry, guys. I'm so sorry, Roger. Roger Dannenberg was the inventor of Audacity. And he is coming out of retirement, in a sense. He no longer works directly with the project, from what I understand. But he's agreed to speak to us in a couple of weeks, trying to get him out there. And again, the name I don't have in front of me, sorry, so I won't even try the name this time. But one of the key leaders on the Wine project. So this is the emulator that helps you run Windows programs directly under Linux.
Except that Wine is not an emulator, of course.
Wine is not an emulator, I know.
Just like GNU is not Unix.
right. So those guys are all on the short list, and I'm bringing them in as soon as I can get the landing slots figured out, because, you know, it's like juggle, but there it is. And please keep those suggestions coming. I love the fact that I'm probably getting 4 pieces of mail a day for suggestions for floss. So I've got a little auto-reply script that says, thank you, I'm putting that in the list because I have to, because now it's just getting big. I am trying to figure out how to make the upcoming list a little more public. So maybe a Google Doc or something somewhere where I can, you know, have it edited so people at least know what is in the queue and
excellent.
What suggestions people
excellent.
Made. So I don't get a lot of redundant suggestions. I don't mind the redundancy because it gives me a sense of what's popular and what people
sure.
really want to have in there.
Sure.
But still, I mean, I don't need, the 72nd request for the same thing. I'm already looking at it. If you can give me a name, that'd help and that sort of thing. But I'm trying to do that. But this is just, again, Leo, got to thank you. This has just been,
we're having a blast.
This is the privilege of a job to work with you on this, to be talking to all these really little people like Simon and everybody else we've had on the show so far. And I'm having a blast.
Want to hear from Alan Kay? Don't give up on him now.
I still ping him every month or two. Okay. So, yeah.
And incidentally, Simon's personal website, The Mink Dimension, is online at webmink.net. And he has a link there on the front page to Stephen Fry's Happy Birthday to GNU wishes, which is from GNU.org in Java, which I think is just fantastic. Mm-hmm. Who would have thunk it, right? Mm-hmm. And we thank you all for joining us. We're going to be back next week with another great Floss Weekly. And we'll see you then. Take care, Randall.
Bye, Leo.